Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Hey, Mr. DJ, put a record on. I wanna dance with my baby.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hey, Mr. DJ.
No tenemos que mostrar ningún papel. No tenemos que decirle nada a nadie. Menos a la migra. Y si la agarran, usted ya sabe qué hacer.
From Pacifica Radio at the Mothership in Berkeley, California, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gabriela Molina and Francisco Herrera. Today on the show, dying for work in front of Home Depot. Brown people from coast to coast under attack by wannabe dictator Donald Trump. We'll hear the voices of workers and their supporters fighting back. And the call for an end to solitary confinement. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
No tenemos que mostrar ningún papel. No tenemos que decirle nada a nadie. Menos a la migra. Y si la agarran, well, you know just what to do. Tenemos derecho de mantener silencio. Tenemos derecho de hablarle a un abogado. No tenemos que firmar ni un documento, porque seguro es para la deportación.
And you are listening to Flashpoints. We are in Berkeley, California, at the mothership KPFA. We have been speaking truth to power since 1949, and we're going to continue doing it despite the wannabe dictator. We're not even going to say his name. Right. We are here, and we are the resistance program. Flashpoints, Miguel Gabriela Molina. It's been another week of brutality in which the man, and I use that word correctly, wants to punish, wants to undermine, wants to create so much suffering and brutality that they purge this country of brown.
Well, that's why ICE, I-C-E, is inhumane cruelty enforcement. That's what that agency is all about. Pain, suffering, and cruelty. But as you said, Dennis, there is massive resistance beginning to mobilize across the country. At the same time, the government is getting ready to wage a unbelievable domestic war against not just the undocumented workforce, but the country itself, yeah, and whatever remnants of freedom and democracy remain. So the resistance is growing.
And we've got two guests, one in the studio, one an old friend of ours, one Jose Gutierrez. In the studio is Angelica. It was Wednesday, right, that there was a protest in San Francisco. The thugs arrived. You were the one of the courageous folks standing there. Tell us what happened when the thugs arrived on Wednesday. What were they wearing? What did they look like? The way I could see it from the pictures, they started it. They were there to do violence.
Absolutely. I mean, their very existence is predicated on the need for this type of fascist violence. I was reflecting on the fact that yesterday was the anniversary of Brother George Jackson's death. Been many years of resistance against this type of fascist terror, and what's happening now with ICE and this new dictator in chief is just another manifestation of the generations of violence and imperial violence that are coming home now. So like you said, the ICE agents showed up at 100 Montgomery yesterday. 100 Montgomery, for those who don't know, is an immigration courthouse for folks who are quote-unquote doing it the right way to come to their regularly scheduled immigration hearings in order to go through the process of becoming citizens. And ICE uses those people's vulnerability at that courthouse to kidnap them. So yesterday, or Wednesday morning, I got a notification along with many other community members that ICE was present in 100 Montgomery, and I and many others showed up. The scene, as soon as I arrived, was chaotic and brutal. ICE was shooting at people with pepper balls. They had pulled out tasers and were threatening to tase people. They were unleashing cans and cans of pepper spray, so much so that they actually ran out of pepper spray at one point and had to go and send somebody to get some more pepper spray. So, you know, people at the courthouse are aware of the reality of just how violent this fascist regime is, and people are prepared to be able to resist.
Well, you got hit pretty hard. Tell us about how you were treated. You were pepper sprayed and arrested.
That's right. I was tackled by a few of them, pepper sprayed, shackled, bound hand and foot, and brought into the garage of 630 Sansom, where I actually got to observe some of the inner workings or the disorganization of this fascist militia. The whole 24 hours I was there was just interagency bickering about what to do with me, because first of all, they're not legally supposed to be arresting me as a citizen in the first place. But second of all, we've learned that 630 Sansom is actually well beyond capacity for the number of immigrants that they're kidnapping. They're only supposed to be kept there a couple of days at most. Immigrants are being held up there for a week or more in squalid, barbaric conditions. No access to restrooms, no access to showers, of course, no access to legal, to their lawyers or to their families. I got just a taste of that. But while I was there, I watched them bring in, for example, one, I believe, South Asian man who was crying and begging and pleading to just be able to speak to his lawyer or to speak to his family. And they responded by laughing, humiliating him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're going to bring in Juan Jose Gutierrez. Juan Jose, good to have you back. These are terrible times, though. You want to give us a sense of, I was watching the whole situation unfold at the home, we're calling it now Home Deport, where a worker was so afraid that he fled into the highway and was murdered. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the situation on the ground and the atmospheric pressure now that people are sort of living under.
Well, before I go there, Dennis, and thank you for inviting me, I wanted to pick up on what the your previous guest was saying he repeatedly used the word fascist paramilitary regime, and I couldn't agree more. And before getting into the Home Depot situation that you mentioned, where another immigrant lost his life, in this case, I wanted to mention that this week we learned that on a direct request from President Donald Trump, the head of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, announced that the whole wall that separates Mexico from the U.S. along the U.S.-Mexico border was going to be painted in color black. She said that the whole practical purpose of doing that it had nothing to do with aesthetics, but that according to experts, the black color absorbs heat in such a way that along arid areas, which, you know, exist along large stretches of the U.S. border, you know, the wall would get so hot that would-be immigrants, undocumented immigrants, who would attempt to otherwise, you know, climb the wall to get over it and try to enter the U.S. unlawfully, you know, wouldn't be able to do so because, you know, the steel would be so hot.
Yes.
You know, this is something that probably went unnoticed to a lot of people, but I wanted to start there because I'm no expert an art interpretation, but I do know this, that during the fascist era, you know, the closest one to us was during World War II, you know, when Benito Mussolini in Italy and Adolf Hitler in Germany, you know, they used the black color, you know, to project fear, you know, project power, authority, intimidate people, right, and spread terror. You know, black, you know, was used also, and according to people that know about these things, you know, it symbolizes the end of something that has life, you know, death itself. And moreover, you know, in fascist terms, during the Nazi period, black was used as a way of glorifying violence and death, and as a political tool, you know, necessary, as Hitler would put it, and so did Mussolini, but more Hitler, you know, to purify the nation. So I think that, you know, that we're not exaggerating when we come to the conclusion in describing what's going on in the country right now on the immigration front as nothing less than the beginnings of an effort to establish a fascist regime in the United States. And from there I go to what happened at the Home Depot over here in Southern Cal, where a presumed undocumented worker tried to get away from, you know, these fascist paramilitary forces. And, you know, he tried to get across the road, and he was run over by a car and lost the, his life. You know, he died. And then, you know, last weekend, another family that were in a car in Riverside, San Bernardino counties, you know, that part of Southern California, were pulled over by presumed agents of ICE. And whatever happened, we don't know at this time. Authorities there, local authorities, are calling for an investigation. These neo-fascists, you know, they pull out their guns and open fire on the family. Fortunately, no one died. There's an ongoing investigation. You know, we need to get to the bottom of this. So that's the kind of stuff that we continue to deal with in Southern California. Some people mistakenly have reported that we're catching, you know, a little recess, you know, a little break on the part of the authorities, immigration authorities, but nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, they continue to carry out raids at various locations, not just the Home Depots, you know, places of employment, et cetera, et cetera. And they continue to arrest and lock up people. You know, they continue to kidnap them. You know, the bounty hunters, you know, the the immigrant bounty hunters, they continue to run amok, and they continue to arrest people in violation of the law. ICE is violating due process. They work for the federal government. They're supposed to follow due process. They're not doing that. But as if that were not bad enough, these bounty hunters, they're going out there and getting immigrants all over the place and just disappearing them because they think they're going to collect some money on them. And I'm assuming that they're doing that, but the suffering and the terror that they're injecting into our communities simply continues to grow. There is absolutely no doubt now that what we're seeing here is an effort to establish a fascist state in this country, and we have to do anything and everything that we can to stop it. And just as Gavilán was saying before I joined this conversation, the good news is that more and more people are assuming and taking very, very seriously what's going on in our country, and they're getting ready to do battle. They're getting organized. They're getting mobilized. And I'm talking about all segments of our society, attorneys, labor organizers, people from the faith community, students, you name it. Everybody's joining in, and I'm very encouraged by what I'm seeing, and I do believe that we're going to turn it around.
Absolutely, Juan Jose, and thank you for joining us. You made a mention about the wall. Well, one of the things about the wall, it doesn't matter how tall it is or how wide it is. The symbol of our freedom as the brown raza in this country is the monarch. Yeah. And the monarch doesn't see borders. No wall is going to stop the monarca, the majestic butterfly. Yeah. So, and looking at the border itself, our roots as a people in this area, the Southwest, what we call Aztlan, Northern Mexico, our roots run deeper than any border wall will ever. So people that are fleeing hunger and violence, no wall's going to stop them. They can paint it black all day. That, to me, was a show for Kristi Noem. She was there. She got in a painter's uniform, and she had a, paint brush roller, and it all was for show. It's for drama. A lot of the stuff that the administration does is just for show, just for drama, to dramatize, to instill fear. Well, that's no pader, no wall, no moro is ever going to stop people fleeing hunger and injustice. But that said, as we speak right now, the Immigration and Custom Enforcement has launched a recruiting drive calling for heroic, patriot Americans, to come out to defend the homeland by serving as deportation officers. And in some cases, they're offering, up to $50,000 bonuses. They're also offering to suspend student loans and that's happening, and we're really going to see it really get extremely tense in October when the budget, when the money kicks in, which has been $170 billion to reinforce ICE. So that's what we got coming. But as you said, and as I said, people are organizing on every level. But I think at this point, one of the things that I'm concerned about is you have this SS, what I call SS militia. Mm-hmm. They're to us in the barrio, in the colonias, in the Spanish-speaking communities, these are bandidos. These are, people that are, bounty hunters, body snatchers, abductors, kidnappers. If they're going to be part of this, then one of the things I hope legislatures, local officials, from local mayors to district representatives in the California Senate and the legislature, but also the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate, is to start putting certain demands. If they're going to be part of ICE, and ICE is going to balloon up to 20 to maybe 30,000 more, individuals being hired to hunt down humans, that's what is happening here. Then those individuals, those bounty hunters that are masked, you can't see who they are, they're going to have to identify yourselves, have an ID, show your face. So the campaign is unmask ICE. the thugs, because that's what they are. They're not professionally trained to be police. They're not sheriffs. They're not, highway patrol officials. They're not even FBI. They're not even ICE. What are these, you know, out of the 1,600 that he released, you know, convicted criminals that started the insurrection, a lot of them are getting hired right now to come into
that's
California.
Right. That's right.
So they're...
And if I may add something up to what you're saying, Gavilan, look, the reason why we have to begin to understand that we're dealing with a fascist regime, someone that has no respect for the law, is what's happening on the legal front, right? Just this week, a federal panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, right, authorized the president to terminate, to end temporary protected status for 60,000 immigrants from the nations of Nepal, Honduras, and Nicaragua. You know, 51,000 Hondurans that have been here for at least 26 years enjoying the legal protections of this program will not have it as of September the 8th. From the country of Nepal, 6,000, and from Nicaragua, 3,000. Now, you add to that other decisions by the Trump administration to take legal protections of whatever type for 350,000 Venezuelans and 500,000 TPS protected Haitians. You know, you're talking about a total of 910,000 human beings who have been enjoying some kind of temporary legal protection that allow them to be in this country legally, to work legally, you know, to have a social security number, to pay their taxes, to do everything the right way. And now, shortly, all these individuals will no longer have those legal protections. And so the question becomes, are they going to become targets of these new hires for ICE and other federal agencies that will then go to their addresses because they have them, because all these individuals have had to register with immigration authorities repeatedly in order to secure their work permits. Furthermore, let's also inform the public that as of today, on average, starting from January the 20th, when President Donald Trump swore as the next president of the United States, our current president, on average, they've been arresting 1,200 presumed undocumented workers. They have a goal of 3,000. They've only managed to average about 1,200 people arrested. There's way too many, but they want to, you know, up the ante and get to 3,000. They have proven capacity to detain 46,000, a little bit more than 46,000 individuals in all the current immigration detention centers. As I speak, they have overcrowded these detention centers, these modern day concentration camps. They have 80,000 people in these detention centers. You know, one of your guests said that you know, what he witnessed when he was detained were squalid, barbaric conditions under which presumed undocumented workers are being held. Part of the reason is that the U.S. government only has capacity to hold, at this point, 46,000 detainees. They have 80,000. They've almost doubled the number, and they don't care, you know, that they're violating the law. You know, they don't have space. You know, they shouldn't arrest so many people. They're continuing to do it because they don't value who these individuals are. They, you know, they're not seen as human beings, but, you know, but as something else. I'll conclude by saying that on average today, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, through its ICE agents and so on, they're deporting on average 1,400 individuals per day. So those are the facts. That's the data. It's current. And as you said, Gavilan, we can only wonder what things are going to be like after October, when the month begins, because that's when the new fiscal year runs from October 1 to September 30th of 2026. They have weighed a lot of money and they're hiring new personnel. So one can only expect that the level of repression against undocumented persons is going to like really scale up, and all our communities better be ready for that, because they're operating under a policy that they don't want to take any prisoners.
Before we let you go, Juan Jose Gutierrez, you were talking about a week, a month. Go over those figures again. Right now, where are we in terms of people under arrest?
Now they have 80,000 presumed undocumented workers that have been detained. They're in some immigration detention center. On average, starting January 20th, when Donald Trump came into office for his second term, on average, ICE has been arresting 1,200 individuals per day, and they're deporting 1,400 individuals, 1,400 per day, every day. And that's an average. Sometimes they deport more, sometimes they deport less, but on average, from January 20th to now, they're deporting 1,400, and they're arresting 1,200 individuals per day. They have 80,000 detainees. I mean, this is unbelievable, and it's only the beginning. It's going to get worse.
Gracias. Thank you, Juan Jose Gutierrez. This is Dennis Bernstein. Also with us is Francisco Herrera.
Thank you, Dennis. Gracias, Juan Jose. And I want to bring it back to Angelica. A couple of things, Angelica. One is the deplorable conditions you witnessed, and that they moved you around to Santa Rita, or we didn't know where they had you for several hours. We didn't know anything. But I want to bring out the community, right? What you're talking about, Gavilan, Juan Jose mentioned as well. I mean, we probably might not know where you would be right now if it hadn't been for the strong community support. Tell us a little bit of that experience, Angelica.
Yeah. Like you said, I was shipped to different agencies because they couldn't decide what to do with me. They took me to Stanford Hospital at first after keeping me for a few hours because they were worried that they had injured me. They took me then to Santa Rita, where they argued about whether or not Santa Rita could hold me because SFPD had already told them that they couldn't take me because legally they're not supposed to be collaborating, though we've seen we've seen some non-intervention from SFPD to ICE. But definitely, the entire time that I was inside, I felt blessed knowing that my community, that my comrades, people in different organizations and in labor communities like SEIU were showing up to support me, because many people experience this every day, not knowing where they're going to be sent, whether they're going to be sent back to their home country or to some other concentration camp, some sort of slave camp like Secot in El Salvador. And there's nobody there to support them because their families don't have the resources or the means, because our society has decided to stop caring about people who are being deported, or because we're becoming numb to it. And I want to focus on the fact that these barbaric conditions that I experienced, this lawlessness, this complete lack of accountability from these Gestapo thugs in arresting me and in taking me all around the Bay Area, is the exact same type of lawlessness that immigrants face every single day. Like the other guest was saying, 1,400 a day is an ocean of misery. And I just got to see a little piece of that.
Hmm. And here we are, an ocean of compassion, getting organized to respond to each other. I know one of the strategies people are taking on is Adopt a Corner, where people are actually adopting a corner, a vulnerable space. We're actually moving with family. All the pre-documented families are now preparing a family plan. And part of that plan is neighbors who are saying, I'll adopt your child before the state takes him and sends him off to who knows what, and I adopt him with a commitment that I will reunify him with you if you get attacked.
Absolutely, and it was precisely because I had that community support behind me that I knew that no matter what, my people got me. And that's what we need to start doing, and that's actually why people have been showing up at the courthouse in the first place, because we know that we can't wait for the Democrats, we can't wait for Mayor Lurie, we can't wait for Governor Gavin Newsom, because they're not doing anything. They might give lip service out of one side of their neck about being able to make this a sanctuary city, but they have SFPD stand by while protesters in front of Hunter Montgomery almost get run over by ICE vehicles, while people are being deported every single day. So the community decided to stand up and start providing protective presence themselves at 100 Montgomery Courthouse. And I'm hoping that we're going to start seeing that strategy pivot, like you were saying, in the Adopt a Corner program, to make it clear that if ICE is going to come into our communities and try to kidnap our people, they'll have to go through us first.
And that's something that's really important. Is Juan Jose, are you still there?
I'm still here.
I just wanted to say, Juan Jose, that I know people are getting ready for next weekend. The next Friday, week from this Friday, is Chicano Moratorium, commemorating that effort against the war back in 1969, where Ruben Salazar, one of the most important journalists, Chicano journalists of that time, was murdered by the LAPD and three other students. But I also know that, you know, they're commemorating Chicano Moratorium next Friday and Saturday to deal with the now, to end the war here, to end the domestic war here in the United States by the government. And also the Monday is going to be all over the place Labor Day. And I know that Los Angeles is getting ready for that, having actions, you know, to there's been talks about calling for a general strike, because ultimately this government is not going to respond. It's lawless. There is no government to them. There's a king and no democracy. Is LA getting ready for Labor Day?
Oh, no question about it, but that's going to be preceded, as you mentioned, Gavilan, by actions to commemorate the 55th anniversary of the historic Chicano Moratorium. It happened 55 years ago, on August 29th. There was a mass popular uprising by Chicano youth of that time, who came from all over the country, 40,000 strong. They marched in East L.A., in and around, you know, the heart of East L.A. on Whittier Boulevard. There was a park that at the time was known as Laguna Park. Because of the barbaric repression that we suffered at the hands of the Sheriff's Department and other local law enforcement authorities, there were several Chicanos and Chicanas that were murdered on that day. There were about 25 wounded individuals that were seriously injured by bullets. And one of the persons that lost his life on that particular day was a very beloved news reporter for the LA Times. He was a columnist for that newspaper at a time when you really had to search to find Mexican American minorities in any news company. Certainly the LA Times, who had a historic fame of being very anti-Mexican. But so Ruben Salazar, a war veteran, who was very progressive, he was killed on that day.
A truth-teller.
Officers shot him through the head. His skull was cracked, and he lost his life. At the time, he was also the news editor for KMEX Channel 34, which is, you know, the flagship of Univision Network at that time, right?
They knew who they were killing, didn't they? They knew they were killing the voice.
Yeah, and so they killed him along with a few others. There was mass repression on that day. The community exploded. They torched a couple of blocks all along Whittier Boulevard. I mean, it was a very violent day. You know, but that was a day that put the Chicano community on the map as a community that was no longer going to tolerate the levels of oppression, discrimination, and racism in shipping us out to fight imperialist wars in Vietnam, but without regard to our civil and constitutional rights in the U.S. So we're going to be commemorating the 55th anniversary this coming Saturday, August 29th. We're going to march. We're going to recreate the route that we marched back in 1970, or at least those that march. I was too young to march at the time, but we're going to march, and we're going to end up at this park that's now being renamed has been renamed for some years Ruben Salazar Park in honor of this martyr that gave his life for the rights of his people. And then, of course, after that, on Labor Day, we're going to be joining the L.A. County Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, you know, here in L.A. I mean, we have about close to a million workers under collective bargaining agreements, and so the L.A. County Federation of Labor has decided to lead this huge march to the harbor out in the San Pedro area. I'm going to join them. I've been invited by the head of the county Fed to speak and so on. So we're going to be there, and the call is going to go out that at this point in time, we are being called to step forward and unite. Anybody that doesn't want to unite, at least here in Southern California, we're, you know, we're rejecting that view that they have issues with whomever or with whatever organization. This is no time to be playing games. We have to come together because the challenge of the fascist forces in America, led by President Donald Trump and his team, is a serious danger to our democracy with its defects, as they may still exist. But nonetheless, we're in course, you know, to fall off a cliff if we don't do the right thing and unite, organize, and mobilize in an effective way to eventually get to the point of what Gavilan already told us, you know, which will be general strikes across America until this grave and serious threat to all of our lives, you know, is ended. Donald Trump must go. We don't need him and his team and his ilk. We have to get rid of them because they're threatening all of us and the entire working class.
We thank you, Juan Jose Gutierrez, for joining us again. We count on you for the extraordinary information and the stand that you're taking for all the people in this state, in this country, really, in this world, standing eye to eye with fascism, saying, no, we're not going to take it. We're not going to stand by and watch this go down because a couple of weak-kneed Democrats don't have the courage to speak truth to power. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Juan Jose, we'll talk to you soon. We're also going to remember what's happening. This is a very important day for Haitians in this world. So we're going to look into that in a moment or two. Francisco Herrera is with us now.
How many years must the people endure before they are seen as human? How many years must my raza be here before seen for real? Gritando está en el viento, a desalambrar, a desalambrar, a desalambrar.
Francisco Herrera here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are in the mothership. And we also have a contribution from a relative of yours. And we want to be mindful that this is an incredibly important day for Haitians and Haitian liberation. And they are caught in this crossfire, no doubt.
Very much so. And just to add with Juan Jose, that September 1st, also at 16th and Mission, at 11 a.m., 16th and Mission, 11 a.m., will be the March for Labor Day, and we'll go from 16th and Mission to Dolores Park that coming Monday, and the beginning of our general strike. But yes, exactly on this day in 1791 was launched the revolution in Haiti that really was the first truly democratic republic in the American continent, modern times, because there's previous to the British and Spanish and the Portuguese being here, there was a lot of democratic examples being lived out. But in modern times, after the invasion and the genocide in our lands here, Haiti exactly today, in 1791, launched the revolution and liberated themselves from the enslaving French. And MC Paws, who I'm so honored to call my son, and has honored me and our family, came up with a wonderful song with the help of Pierre Labossiere, and it's really recalling not just that revolution, but also the efforts that throughout the dictator, the U.S.-backed dictatorship of Duvalier, and the coming of President Aristide, and the creation of UNIFA, the University of Medical Students that lives on today in Haiti. This is a song called La Valas.
What's happening to the people of Haiti? Punish the baby mothers and fathers holding their babies. Been getting many since the one summer they put in Moisey. Corruption finally got them in, cause of us it's been noisy. With no sleep for the Haitian citizens, take with them what they can. They shouldn't have to leave, they're innocent. When really the occupation put them in this predicament. We so sick of it, duty movement to the infinite. Thousands migrating, can you imagine if this happened to your family? Plagues of the earth leaving your home, surviving tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. They pull up to the border where humans are trafficking, but they won't let them in. Instead they pulling out their whips. Is it 2022 or 1776? I can't tell the difference. All of these turbulent times just cause your motion sickness. This country's living a lie, no democratic finish. Oh, 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 ah, liberation to tap in Anacaona. Two groups been suffocating the country like anaconda. They breathing, the only invading white seats defeated. The people love a lot through lava laws won't be conceded. Through earthquake and hurricanes, still got important gains. They showing us a democracy that could take the pain and flip it to political ticket. They need people in solidarity, not flashing for gimmicks. Hear the rooster crowing, they blow the conch shell. The originators to show us how we all rebel. It's hard to find leaders like a President Aristide, who's for the people, making the whole country believe. Cause they already seen that freedom as possible by funding a university that's a hospital to show folks how to heal. It's all about navigating your way around the field. We all gotta have their backs for this to be revealed.
Love is like cough, you cannot hide it. I love my people, my country, I cannot hide it.
Beautiful. And we are going to be doing a great deal more coverage on the situation on the ground in Haiti.
Yes.
Of course, the United States government has been destabilizing that country for decades, causing great suffering. You know, we always think of it, oh, the poor country. It's not a poor country.
No,
it's a resource-rich country. But the United States government cannot stand that black people have self-determination. I tell you, Francisco, I remember walking through the streets of Port-au-Prince with Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Thousands of people. He didn't need any protection. He didn't need a protection force. There were no people around protecting him.
He didn't need 300 soldiers around him.
No, he didn't need the soldiers. The people, he was in a nest of love. And that's what the United States government couldn't stand. And so their policy has led to turning Haiti into a drug operation in terms of the corrupt government that the U.S. has facilitated.
And I think That was Martins, or MC Paz's, intention with the song, is to bring attention to Haiti. And people can actually get it at, what's it called, Bandcamp, but also support, get more information at HaitiEmergencyRelief.org, HaitiEmergencyRelief.org, for more information, because that's right, it's the powerful people of Haiti. Haiti is actually our teacher. You know, people say poor this and poor that, and poor little immigrant, or poor people of Haiti. No. Haiti is our teacher, who showed us how to get rid of an empire in the late 1700s in an effective way. And then, Dennis, what isn't told is how the Haitian revolutionaries then went on to Latin America and parts of the United States to teach the different revolutionary bands how to get rid of the Spaniards and how to get rid of the British. All that stuff. It's just amazing that is not paid attention to.
And an important thing that I can never forget is when the U.S. government invaded in 2004 to kidnap Jean-Bertrand Aristide, they turned the medical center that Aristide had founded into barracks for the military. And that was the message that the United States government, we don't want you to build hospitals and schools. If you're not going to be a military muscle acting on our behalf, you're not going to survive. But the Haitian people will be back.
That's right.
That's clear.
And they're back. And so that's why I love the image of the ocean of community that we are. Here they are, training thousands of Haitians to be medics, to be doctors, to be health workers, all kind in the university that they funded, that President Aristide and his wife Mildred Aristide are still running today. And I think it's all of that powerful ocean of love, ocean of compassion. And speaking of which, we have our good brother Luaya from the Peace Poets, who riveted the space last week with his spoken word and the work he's been doing around the country. He's back on the road. Luaya spends most of his time supporting conferences, organizing campaigns, bringing the power of song, the power of chanting, the power of poetry to energize the people, to energize the movement. And welcome back, Luaya.
Peace and blessings, relatives. It's so good to be with you. Thank you, Francisco. Thank you, family. Thank you all for speaking and moving with the truth. I feel it.
Ho!
I'm honored to continue on the theme today of people showing up for people. So today I'm going to do a poem, Que Viva Haiti, that long live Haiti, long live all the pueblos of these lands and all lands who support each other. Right now, as they escalate their war of division, we are escalating a beautiful offensive of solidarity. So this poem today is called Falling in Solidarity. And for you who's out there thinking about the ways in which you're going to show up for our neighbors, our friends, our families, our children, I pray that it may arrive to you like a hug to give you courage to continue to organize. This is for everybody putting together all of those rapid response networks, beautiful things happening. This poem is for you. I am falling. Like 100 million marching to break up their backroom deals. I am falling. Like a hungry man standing over a home-cooked meal. I'm falling. Like it's ridiculous how much hope my people make me feel. I am falling in solidarity with you. And solidarity ain't easy. And people throw that word around a lot these days, so you might not believe me, but this is real. I think about you all the time. I got your brilliance on my mind, and I'm dying to intertwine your struggle and mine. I want to be with you. When we are marching to abolish ICE, I want to get free with you. And I don't mean to be too forward, but I think you're stunning. Running circles around cops who have no clue how to stop the wildfire, you inspire optimism in me. And these days, that's hard to find. But through the darkness, I see your mind as the inside of a long-lost shrine to what we could become. You make me want to make love political and hate unpopular and war improbable and people unbombable. I want to wrap my arms around yours and block the doors of military recruiting facilities. Because if they don't stop killing innocent people, we won't have to occupy the military. This solidarity has me ready to be a wrench in systems of exploitation, to reimagine nations, write General Assembly declarations like love letters, you make me better. And I never thought I'd fall this deep, but you got me swimming in freshwater dreams of a world where human beings are seen as too precious to ever be exploited as machines. So please, let's do this right. Keep our communication tight. And remember that even if we fight, the future generations are depending on us to be the light. I promise not to burn out. I will stay with you, chill with you, build with you, and I'm gonna keep it real with you. This is gonna hurt sometimes, because there will be moments when I don't want to sacrifice a night's sleep or march out in the rain. But you love me, and so you patiently explain there's no separating solidarity from pain. For solidarity to exist, it means we share the risk of each other's struggle. That means this might get me in some serious trouble, locked up or even killed. But why would I want to be safe and comfortable while so many are evicted and robbed, tortured and bombed? I'd rather lose my crib, my health, and my job than lose you. You are the movement of my grandchildren's dreams. You are the soundtrack to sing back the possibility of peace. You are a rebellious song lifted along the jagged edges of a Haitian revolutionary's heart, and you are part of me. So let there be no doubt, no hesitation, and no fear that I am in solidarity with you, my people. And that is why I'm here, where we take the clay of history into our joined hands and remember a time before the people pretended to own land, and the clay will soften, and a child will read a poem, and the love within us all will say, at least they're coming home, and we will grasp the tides of movements and moments and lives and deaths, and yes, we will all fall and over heels, and it will feel like rising up.
We thank you, my brother. It reminds me of this line that my poetry teacher shared. It was actually three lines, but they were the same. Pay attention to what they tell you to forget. Pay attention to what they tell you to forget. Pay attention to what they tell you to forget. That's from Muriel Rukeyser. We thank you, my brother. We're running out of time. There is a special event, Francisco, coming up that KPFA is a part of on September 4th at St. John's in Berkeley. And we want to invite somebody who is standing. It's all about making the case against solitary confinement, which is unbelievably still a key part of the U.S. Destructive prison system. I know a lot about it. I spent 10 years teaching in Rikers Island. Moral issues. I taught Gandhi to prisoners. And at Sing Sing, the same thing. At Sing Sing, where the lights flickered when they put somebody to death. And the prison system continues. I'm thinking I'd like to welcome Dr. Terry Coopers, who is going to be a part of the event taking place on September 4th. Dr. Coopers, welcome to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us. Tell us why. What's your best case for ending solitary confinement? I'm for ending prisons altogether, but please share with us.
Well, I'm happy to. Thank you for having me on. I'm a psychiatrist, and I testify in court all the time about solitary confinement, people who are just extremely damaged by it. So I list symptoms like anxiety, paranoia, pacing, mental breakdown that happens typically in solitary. And I'm arguing it's an Eighth Amendment violation, the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. The United Nations takes it a step further. In 2012, the Special Rapporteur of the United Nations on Torture said that solitary confinement more than 15 days is torture. That was 2012. In today's world, look what's going on with ICE and these raids where armed thugs who have no badges on them are grabbing people who haven't done anything, driving them away in trucks and putting them in detention centers. They say it's about immigration, but it's not immigration, because anybody who raises any kind of question about what they're doing also gets arrested. And then ICE has the reputation from years, I've done many cases with ICE, they use solitary confinement more and leave people in solitary longer than even the state prisons and the federal prisons. So what we have is solitary confinement is a critical part of the current police state that's evolving. Juanita Harris, who is one of the four authors of the book, I'm another, Ending Isolation, which we'll be talking about at the September 4th event, has an article about Black August in today's Truth Out. And she says, among other things, George Jackson understood that solitary confinement is not merely punishment for rule infractions, but a deliberate strategy to break the will of those who possess the audacity to challenge an inherently unjust system. In other words, it's a terror campaign. Gets people so frightened of solitary that they'll stop protesting and they'll give up their free speech rights.
You know, Doctor, one of my students, at first it didn't hit me how powerful it was, but in one of the piece was actually titled, "We're Getting Used to Prison." And he was making the case that the point is that the more we accept it, the more we get used to it, and the bigger the prisons get. And here we are under Donald Trump, who wants to turn this entire country into, I guess you could say, a minimum security prison. It really is a problem that people accept the amount of people that we now have jailed, not just in solitary confinement, but from coast to coast, and more jails are on the way.
That's right. And in the jails, solitary confinement looms over everybody. People become compliant. They stop standing up for their rights because they're terrified of going to solitary confinement. We have 144,000 people in prison in solitary confinement today. And what that means is that just about everybody spends some time in solitary confinement. So the terror campaign starts in the prison, but then it goes on in the community. So people are terrified of the ICE agents right now, the National Guard, the Marines invading the cities. And what's looming in the end is the harsh punishment of solitary confinement if you break the rules.
Yes, Dr. Cooper, thank you. This is Francisco Herrera here with you. And to add to that, and we know in California, when they decided to start building prisons to up to 35 about two decades ago, they were measuring how many people could read in the third grade to define how many prison cells they were going to be making, which only adds to the defunding of our educational system and preparing entire populations for this treatment, no?
Absolutely. And one of the book that I've had the honor of being a co-author of, Ending Isolation, is mainly written by prisoner journalists. And it's amazing. They entered with a third or fourth grade education. They entered the prisons. They educated themselves. They went to the library. They learned to read, to write. They studied law. And their contributions to the book, Ending Isolation, really means it's the voice of the oppressed about what's wrong with solitary confinement.
My students had no problem understanding Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Mahatma Gandhi. I just watched them as they read in class, shaking their heads with the epiphanies and the understanding, and what the education that they never got did to them, undermined their lives. We're just about out of time. But again, Dr. Terry Cooper, is in a final minute, what do you think is the most important focus of the evening, of the gathering that's happening on September 4th that you're going to be a part of, that Kat Brooks is helping to co-host at St. John's in Berkeley?
Well, It's a double event. It's first of all the release of the book Ending Isolation, which, as I say, is a collaboration with a large group of prisoner journalists, and it's the launching of a national bus tour, the Journey to Justice bus tour, which is a campaign to end solitary confinement. We need to fight at every level and take our country back. We need mass demonstrations and protests. We need legal lawsuits. We need legislative campaigns, and the campaign to end solitary confinement is combining all those three things, and people should come out, come to the September 4th event, and join the struggle.
And how do people follow your work and how you are engaged in resisting? Well, what's the best way?
Well, there's a couple of websites that are very important. Unlock the Box is one, and you can just look that up. Unlock the Box and Solitary Watch are two websites. Both of them publish the words of prisoners, and follow them. My work is published in there, too.
Thank you for joining us. We appreciate the time and the great work you're engaged with.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
You're incredibly welcome. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Of course, it's also an honor always to have in this studio my good brother, Francisco Herrera, our troubadour, our resident troubadour, who has been playing music for the people for many years. And he's going to take us out.
And remind people that we have an Adopt the Block, Adopt the Corner training. People can call 415-529-9675. 415-529-9675. It's Tuesday at the 4:30. Tuesday the 26th at 4:30. Open your eyes, baby. Un día vas a ver tu madre, tu padre florecer. Child, un día vas a ver tu pueblo, tu gente libre ser. Atrévete a soñar. Atrévete a soñar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
On the next episode of NeuroEmergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely.